So, welcome. You are listening to KDVS 90.3 FM. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz, and it is time now for Office Hour. Before we begin, I want to remind you that the views that are contained in this hour may not reflect the views of KDVS, the KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. So, it's time for Office Hour, and as we always do on Tuesday at 5 o'clock, we knock on someone's door. So can you hear? We're going around the campus, knocking on doors, finding out what are all these faculty, what are these staff, what is the student, what's everybody up to in these big funded by the state buildings. So here in Public Affairs, we lead you inside the secret, what's going on in the offices. And I'm extremely pleased today. I think it's going to be a really interesting show. I'm knocking on the door of the Minetti Schrim Museum of Art, place where we haven't knocked on any doors yet. And I'm taking you into the office of the curator and director, Rachel Teagle. So welcome to the show, Rachel.
Great to be here.
Okay, so we're going to be talking today about all kinds of things, about modern art, about collecting art, showing art, and about some of Rachel's particular research. But before we begin that, we always start with the same question. And I think it's a good, very poignant question today. When does someone wake up thinking, I would like to run a museum, I would like to be a curator? What is the experience or the inner drive or the desire that led you to this somewhat unusual profession?
Naomi, one of the reasons I loved the opportunity to come back to the world of academia is I have a great answer. My senior year of college, I took a class, an art history class, my very first one, where a professor changed my life. I couldn't believe how cool the topic was. I couldn't believe the way she was interpreting Frederick Remington paintings, of all things. She blew my mind, and I wanted more.
Okay. So are you listening out there, students? Any students listening out there today? I mean, I suppose there are, you know, non-students as well. Sign up for an art history class. It could change your life. And listen, it happened senior year. I really like stories like that because I think sometimes students are afraid. They're afraid that their life might be changed late in their career. So here's somebody who had an experience as a senior in college and lived happy to tell the story.
Absolutely. Really. I actually think I disagree with President Obama on this one and only topic, that art history is a very versatile career. You can go into the market. You can go into museums. You could become a professor.
Right, right. So what particular path after you got turned on to paintings? I must admit, maybe we'll come back to Remington. I've walked by many a Remington. So you can tell us why I should pause at them more than I do sometimes. What was it in particular about curation that became so compelling to you?
Well, this part of the story I'm a little embarrassed to tell on an academic campus. I went to graduate school fully expecting that I would become a faculty member, and it was a process of personal revelation. I remember the very sunny day in May when it was a Saturday late in the afternoon, a perfect afternoon day, and I walked outside and I just thought, wow, it is not me to spend all day in the archive. I am not happy. What am I going to do? Mm. And that is when I realized one of the great things about art history is it had this very real career of working in museums with people, with objects, all the same content that I was so in love with, but a different context. And that switch to museums was really important for me.
Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that people out there who may not personally know a curator. So you got a degree in museumship?
I have a PhD in art history. That's how much I thought I was on the path to pursue work as a faculty member. But while I was very lucky, I was at Stanford, and a private collector hired me to work for him. So I worked the whole time I was pursuing my PhD, and it was work with his collection that allowed me to really develop the curatorial skills I needed while I was pursuing a degree in art history.
And well, that's a very interesting story, actually. So I think that it's always interesting for me to hear that there are many routes into different kinds of professions. And we tend to think, particularly today, when that's such a national emphasis on professionalism, that you go to this kind of pre-training for whatever, pre-professional training, and you got into it through the experiential route. You had the experience of being hired and working with the collection, and from there, and now you ended up at our fantastic museum.
And I'm so happy to be here.
Right. So maybe we should, if there's anybody out there who hasn't been to the museum, that's your homework. now, okay? That's a homework, to go to the museum if you haven't been to the Minetti Schrem.
So, especially because we're free for all. The barriers to entry couldn't be lower. You got to come out.
That is true. And I was reading, before we go on, I just wanted to comment on exactly that point, that I was reading an interesting study about millennials and how much they make use of different forms of art like theater and ballet and opera and museums. And price barrier is a real concern for them because they don't always have a lot of money. They're often coming carrying a lot of student debt. And so the price point is important. And I think in that way, our museum shines because it is for all those millennials who are, you know, watching their dollars for good reason. It's a free museum. So, okay, so for anybody who hasn't been there, let's tell them a little bit about it. It's the Minetti Schrem Museum of Art. It was opened in 2016. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about the architects here. It was a combination of a local architect named Jackson, is that correct, with a group from Brooklyn with the odd name of So Il. I'm not even sure whether you say that correctly. It's S-O-I-L. So can you tell us a little bit about the architects?
Absolutely. It's a very high concept name for the architectural firm. The lead architect was Florian Eidenberg. He's the I in the So I-L.
Mm.
And one of the great pleasures of our building, and there are many, is that this is Florian's first ground-up building in the United States. He's done a lot of smaller projects here in the U.S. He's done buildings in Korea and the Netherlands. This is his first building in the U.S., and we knew that going into the process. We've spent a lot of time as an institution looking at the really incredible history of the arts at UC Davis. And one of the things that has always impressed me is we can rattle off these names of all these famous artists who've come out of UC Davis. Wayne Thiebaud, Robert Arneson, Bruce Nauman,
right.
Manuel Neri. When they were hired by UC Davis, nobody knew who they were.
Right.
Their fame came to them through their experience of working at UC Davis. And we wanted to hire an architect and give them a platform to really make a name for themselves. Quite frankly, we also wanted somebody who was hungry to make a statement. Mm-hmm. And I think Florian really achieved on that front. He knew this was his opportunity. This would be his calling card. And believe it or not, in the world of museum design, $1,000 a square foot budget is very small. And Florian really over-delivered.
Mm-hmm. So if you were telling somebody who'd never been there, what sort of characterized, how would you describe? You can think of art museums as often being quite iconic. Often people can recognize them from a block or two away. For a long time, they would be sort of the neoclassical or the classical style, and you would kind of know you're walking through a city, and you'd say, oh, this is either a city hall or an art museum. You know? And that has completely changed. That in the current construction, we have all kinds of dramatic, maybe looking at something like the Guggenheim as being a turning point where the Guggenheim, the shape of it, the building, it was completely something new and exciting. So how would you characterize to somebody our building?
Well, we actually put a couple of really clear prerogatives out to the architects as part of the design competition. And one of them was we talked exactly what you're talking about of the old model of art museums up on a hill, on top of steps, organized to keep the riffraff out, quite frankly. And we said, we want the exact opposite. We want our building to be welcoming, to be open. We knew that there are probably a lot of students on the UC Davis campus who have never been to an art museum before, and we wanted them to feel welcome and that literally there were no barriers to walking into our building. Welcoming was a huge priority for us. The other thing that we said was we want our museum as a future institution, and therefore our architecture as well, to announce our connection to the legacy, this great legacy of achievement at UC Davis.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be achieved many ways, but we wanted our building to look so native to the spirit of Davis that it looked as if it had grown out of our own earth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the architects achieved that.
So the welcoming idea is partly that it has this very large canopy over the front entrance, the grand canopy, in which you feel often, because it's warm in Davis, it's very inviting to go under the grand canopy. So that's part, I think, of what you're talking about in terms of the welcoming idea. And then it feels very simple to enter. You don't feel like there's a big barrier you have to go through. So you just go under the canopy and you enter very easily. So I understand that. I think that's quite interesting to think about. How do you think this reflects the sort of art history tradition of Davis? I'm curious if you could describe that a little bit in this particular building.
Well, you've just called out my very favorite thing about our architecture. And I think if I was talking to someone who had never seen the building, what I would call out is the play of light and shadow. Mm. And right now in the height of summer, it's to spectacular effect. Florian Eidenberg, in his very first meeting with our team, showed us a painting of Wayne Thiebaud. And those of you who know Wayne's painting know that one of Wayne's iconic gestures is he has these beautiful shadows, blue and purple shadows that fall behind every object. And Wayne says that's because of the clear, crisp light of the Central Valley, that you can see that shadows have edges and colors. And Florian came to us and said, the play of light and shadow has to be what your building is about. And over the course of the design process, we talked a lot about the movement, the dynamic feeling of light in the space. And quite frankly, it sounded like a lot of architect ease, you know, the kind of things that never really come to pass.
Yeah, yeah.
I think what's so impressive about their achievement is that when people come into the building to this day, they kind of stop and are startled by, wow, the light is so beautiful. Mm-hmm. I can see the light changing. I can see the sun moving. To me, that's the real achievement of our building.
Okay, well, that is beyond description. So clearly, people are just going to have to go and have that experience of the light themselves. So now it's built, opened in 2016, correct?
In November 2016.
In November, exactly. So what I'm curious your ideas about what is the role of the museum, the art museum, on a campus. I mean, I think there's a general question in America today about what is the role of the art museum. I went to the exhibit, the one at the Berkeley Art Museum that was make your own stuff. So everybody was there making things.
One of my favorite exhibitions,
I'll admit. So, and there, that was David Wilson, I think. His idea was that the point of having an art museum is to get everybody in there making things. And one could say that it was somewhat of a controversial exhibit, and not everybody thought it was so terrific because people were arguing about what is the role of the art museum. And I think that question is doubled on a campus in terms of why do we build a big building and collect a lot of art when we're not, for example, a city? What is the special role that an art museum can play on a state university campus?
Well, I'm glad you're just asking the toughest question there is about our purpose. But I say that because it's a question we really grapple with on a regular basis. We are the only university art museum in the United States, for example, with a wet studio dedicated to making. And if you've been there on the weekend and over the summer every day, the studio is open. You can come in and you can make on site. We chose to do that because one of the really important aspects of what made UC Davis's founding art faculty distinctive is that they were dedicated to making. I'm sure many people know there are plenty of art programs that are about theory, that are about politics, and this was a group of makers, and we felt it was important to keep that spirit alive in our museum.
Mm-hmm.
There are many ways that we believe we serve the campus. Three of our spaces are classrooms that are filled all the time. Education out front was an important message. We wanted people to come and visit our museum and see students learning about art, making art as part of their visit to the campus. We see a very fundamental role is being a champion for the arts on campus and how the arts can support all kinds of creativity well beyond the liberal arts. But we also are exploring with ways, how do we serve students as individuals? How do we serve faculty members as individuals? There was an assumption when I started working here that chemistry faculty would want to see art about chemistry. And I love the number of times that faculty in far-flung fields have come to me and said, I want the exact opposite. I want the opportunity to come to your museum to think about something I never think about as part of my regular workday life.
Mm-hmm.
So part of what we're trying to do is be a place for important community dialogue. But one of the other things I've been trying to argue with my staff that one of our metrics of success should be to count the number of student dates that come to our museum.
Mm-hmm.
We get to be just a fun social space, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm totally in favor of that. There's an ice cream store for a long time around the corner from my house that had an incredibly long line. And our theory was it was just a very good place to take a first date because you stood in line for a long time and you got a chance to chat without making any kind of commitment. And I think that since closed, I think that there's a real role for a place for people to have conversations and to stimulate conversations. So everything you said makes a lot of sense to me. And, you know, having, I think it's great to have making there. I wonder whether, and I realize this is a hard question, which I'm glad I'm asking and I don't have to answer, which is there something different about the kind of exhibits that you put on in, or the way in which you see the relationship between the exhibit and the audience when you're in a art museum that's connected to a campus? Or is that sort of all exhibits are sort of attempts to be educational in a certain kind of way? So I don't know whether we have a hyper-educational role in the way that we display art or not. So I just want to pick your brain on this because I'm not sure I have an answer myself.
Well, I think different university art museum directors would give you different answers. Mm-hmm. I will tell you that I think our role is very different from the Civic Museum and that we've been particularly conscious about that here because the Crocker Art Museum is 20 minutes away. We think it's really important that you get a very different experience at the Minetti-Schrem Museum. And one way that we're different, one glorious way we're different, is that we do not have to do exhibitions that are guaranteed to bring hundreds of thousands of people to pay the admission fee.
Yes.
That's a lot that civic museums think about just to keep the doors open. Thanks to the support of the university, we can be more experimental and we can be more issue-based. Mm-hmm. So looking for projects, one of the things we do across the board when we're thinking about exhibitions we can bring in is we think about our legacy, but we also think about, with as much important, what topic is the artist or group of artists dealing with that can connect to as many different parts of the curriculum as possible? So, for example, we did Dimensions of Black, which mm-hmm. was a group show, I think a year and a half ago. What was great about that show is, of course, we had art classes come in. We had families from throughout the region come in. We had AFAM studies. We had history classes. We had a poetry class. We're really looking for issue-based exhibitions that connect broadly. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's something civic museums often do.
No, I think that's a very good point because they're often watching their, as you say, the dollar question is one that they have to bring in things that are so important to just to bring in the bread and butter to pay for the museum. So I think that's extremely interesting. I realize when I look at the exhibits and the ones that I've seen there, they often do have, even though you say the main role is not political, there's certainly a close connection in the world today between contemporary art making processes and political issues. And that's another thing which I've thought about, and I'd be very curious to hear your ideas on why is it that so much of modern art does seem to be very highly politicized and to relate to political issues. If we get a chance, maybe we can talk more a little bit. You just came back from the biennial in Venice, and many of the pieces there were explicitly political. I know one of the things that was put on display was the boat mm-hmm. that the immigrants were on that sunk. So I'm curious what you think, and I imagine that also relates to the role, because we're involved in a community of many young people, many of whom are politically involved. But at a more abstract level, why is it that so much political contemporary art is so politically connected?
I think it is very sad today how much art has to self-justify why it is important that we have artists in our communities. I think that leads a lot of artists to take on issues of social and political justice. And it's a very confusing time to understand what art's role is in this larger social dialogue. One of my critiques of the Venice Biennale would be that, in essence, there were all these passionate statements about migrants' rights,
yes.
about food scarcity. And it was all about raising awareness, but it was raising awareness to the converted.
Yeah.
And I went with my 14-year-old and my 12-year-old, and I felt the need to afterwards talk about, wow, okay, there are a lot of problems in the world. What are we going to do about it? And all of those wonderful art projects didn't have any direction about, okay, I understand food availability is a major problem in the world. What next?
Mm-hmm.
So it's an area where I see art as really struggling to find its footing and to really find a clear role.
So it's an interesting point. Your idea would be then that if artists weren't having so much sort of a self-existential crisis about what does it mean to be an artist, they wouldn't worry so much about their footing. And maybe it's the marginalization of art itself that has brought on the political connection. Is that sort of the point?
I think that's a fair rephrasing. I think if artists didn't have to work so hard to justify their utility, that perhaps there wouldn't be so much work with social engagement. Of course, there's some artists whose entire purpose in making art is around these issues of social engagement. The tricky question comes to what ends, because raising awareness, I think, is a topic that the social utility of raising awareness at this moment in time in 2019, I think that's a hard argument to justify.
Well, what did you think about the art as art? Did you think that because it was working so hard to make these political statements, that at the end, that's what you talked about with your children, as opposed to the many times I've been with my children at the end of the exhibit where we'll talk about something about how the color, the line, the way in which we felt moved by the beauty, the starkness, something like that. So that was this political statements often, do you think, at the expense of some of the experiences we might otherwise have looking at art? And what would you say about that?
Well, I'm going to flip the question a little bit by going back to the example that you brought up of the boat that was on display by the Swiss-Icelandic artist Christoph Buckel. I don't know if I've said that correctly. But a boat where hundreds of Libyan refugees died in the hull of that boat. And they literally pulled the boat out of the ocean and put it on display. And the reason that I take that question back to the boat, what was so startling to me, Naomi, about the boat, is the boat itself, where it was placed in the Biennale against the construct of the Arsenale and the blue sky, it was one of the most startlingly beautiful objects in the show. And you had everything to talk about with that boat. There was a very real aesthetic and very beautiful presentation of the boat itself. It was emotionally rending, like just difficult to stand a foot away from a spot where hundreds of people had died. And you saw how teeny tiny it was. They had to be cheek to jowl in that space. So I thought that was, even though it was controversial, one of the most successful pieces in the show, because all of those feelings, beauty and tragedy, were in such close proximity that it was overwhelming and complicated and, to me, everything that you would want really great art to be.
Okay, so contrast that with a piece that was also making a political statement that you felt as art was less successful.
Well, there were some beautiful paintings by a Swiss artist who went to Mexico and commissioned native weavers to create weavings that she hung next to the paintings that she copied from their weavings. They were lovely. They were pretty. I wouldn't mind living with one in my house. But I felt that the artist wanted me to have a lot more political import from that work than I felt it delivered.
So it didn't manage to convey the kind of, in this case, you would say, emotional connection that you want to have from a really important piece of art. But going back to the ship, if you think about it, did the person who put the ship there do anything to the ship other than, in your mind, the incredibly clever placement in an incredibly beautiful part of Venice?
You know? It was all placement, and it wasn't just beautiful. They placed it very thoughtfully next to a historic steam crane, one of the few left in the world. And there's a placard explaining this outdated technology that they're trying to rescue. It was outside the Arsenale on the edge of the water. You could hear the lapping of the water against the wall. So the context it created to put you in that moment of tragedy, I have goosebumps telling you about it now because it was that big of an effect on me.
Right. Whereas there was something that may have been quite decorative or beautiful about the native women's weavings and the paintings, but that didn't give you any goosebumps, I take it.
Those paintings didn't make it hard for me to sleep at night, and that boat has stuck with me when I close my eyes at night.
Terrific. Okay, well, we have actually reached the end of our first segment today, so we're going to take a quick break. We're going to have service announcements, and then we will return for the second half of Office Hour today. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz, talking with the curator of the Minetti Schramm Museum, Rachel Teagle. So stay with us, and we will be right back. So welcome back. This is Office Hour with Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz. And today we're talking about the Minetti Schramm Art Museum. And as we already said, everybody's homework today, Rachel, everybody's homework before next week is to go and see the that welcoming canopy that we described. And we were talking about international art, and I want to bring it a little bit closer to home and talk about one of the artists that's very much associated with UC Davis and also someone on whom you have done some research. We always like to talk about our guests' particular research, and that is Wayne Thiebaud. I have lived for many years with a Thiebaud. I have a Thiebaud print that he signed. That's the poster for the Visions and Revisions that I bought when I first came as a young Davis professor. And I've lived with it very happily, the watermelon slice. And I'm so sad because his signature is fading, you know, but it's made me so I've thought a lot when I was getting ready for the show today about how much pleasure I've had from that particular slice of a watermelon that I've looked at maybe for 20 years in my kitchen. And you've written quite a bit about him, and obviously he's an important person for Davis. So I think we should start off, if there's anybody out there who's never seen any of his paintings, I highly recommend Googling them. We're going to help you because nobody knows how to spell Thiebaud, let alone say Thiebaud. So the last name is Thiebaud. He's now 98 years old, so he's been painting for a long time. So how would you sort of characterize, I realize that there's a lot of different kinds of paintings, but again, to just start us off, how would you characterize his work? A lot of it is lonely food, I would sort of say. Sort of isolated food objects. My watermelon, I've always felt, was a little lonely, the print of, but, and not unhappy, but sort of lonely pieces of, maybe many of our listeners may have seen his most famous one, which is probably his birthday cakes, don't you think?
There's melancholy in all those paintings.
Yes.
But absolutely, the work he is best known for are solitary foodstuffs, goes back to the 1960s, usually painted on a very undifferentiated white field. Sometimes maybe you can discern it's a white tablecloth against a white wall. But he also does many other bodies of work.
Yes.
I'm delighted to say that this November, at the age of 99, he will open a show in New York City of his mountain paintings.
Wow.
So he's still at it every day in the studio.
Mm-hmm. A great example of many people have written papers, books recently on late thoughts and late work, that somebody at often musicians, painters at 99 are doing some of their most wonderful work. So we have this sort of individualized fruit. And one of the many interesting comments you make about it is that it's actually kind of oddly placed on the plane of the painting. I think that's quite true, that it's not very, even though it looks like a cake and everybody would recognize it as a cake, it looks like a watermelon. It actually kind of lives in a kind of never, never space. It doesn't, you know, and there's something quite brilliant about the way in which he is sort of abstracted it from reality. So it's both very real and unreal at the same time. Can you talk a little bit about this pushed up against the plane way in which the food is depicted, which I think is quite important for his painting?
Well, Naomi, I think it's so interesting that you've not only lived with a poster for 20 years, but you've gotten something from looking at it.
Mm.
I think Wayne is so underappreciated because people think like, oh, happy cupcake, watermelon, happy little subject. But if you spend any time looking at his paintings, all of a sudden they become shockingly complex.
Yes.
And so this pressure of the object pushing right up against the plane, the surface, almost looking as if it could pop up out at you,
mm-hmm.
is part of the trickery he does, where he's very interested. At the end of the day, if you talk to Professor Thiebaud about his painting, he'll say, what I care about is the formality of paint as a material and how color and paint relates to one another on the surface of a campus. And the watermelon, the cupcakes are all a formality to get to this topic that he really cares about, of that magical moment when paint can both be something that we recognize, and also dissolve completely into a formal play of color and paint.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly is characterized by very strong colors. So, and as you say, in the painted ones, a lot of sort of technique. And that's why he's sometimes described as being both a combination of what we think of as abstract expressionist techniques, which is a painter who spent put a lot of care into how the paint is put on the canvas and how we look at the paint. And that sort of belies the idea that it's just about cake. What you're saying is it's a lot about paint. It's a lot about the paint that goes into the cake. And so you quote Hal Foster saying it's a combination of abstract painting technique along with what we would call commercial design. But in this case, he seems to me quite different from what we think of. And I'd be really interested in you helping sort of differentiate for us between other people who make use of what we would call commercial design. Where, for example, like we think of Warhol and many other people who are using images from commerce, commercial design, but he's not quite doing that either. He's really doing his own thing.
It's, again, very well said. One of the arguments of the exhibition that we did last year was that Professor Thibault has suffered from not receiving the critical attention that he should. And one of the reasons he hasn't received enough critical attention is that he was misunderstood as a pop artist for the first 30 years of his career. And if you try and look at him as a Lichtenstein or a Warhol, he does the tricks of pop art very poorly.
Yes.
Wayne would say, that's never what I was interested in. Mm. It was a box that I was put in to good effect. The very first exhibition that Wayne was in with in New York in 1959, he was in with Andy Warhol. Mm. So it was wonderful that he came up with these pop artists. It brought him early acclaim, but it also, certainly in terms of critical reception, shunted him off into the wrong box.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things we did around the exhibition was we brought faculty members together from across Northern California and talked about how they teach Wayne Thibault.
Hmm.
And one of the highest compliments we received was Alex Nemiroff from Stanford said, you know, I'm going to start teaching Wayne Thibault as the culmination of abstract expressionism instead of the start of pop art. And that is where Wayne rightly belongs.
So just to help our listeners think about this very interesting comment, we think of the abstract expressionists as culminating in people like Barnett Newman and, of course, Mark Rothko, where we have large parts of sort of color amorphously floating off into clouds of other parts of color. And people stand in front of them. I've been in many arguments about this. You stand in front of them and you have an emotional experience or you don't have an emotional experience. If you don't have emotional experience, then you're told there's something wrong with you because they're supposed to, you know, bring something mythical, almost a mythical consciousness and a kind of poignancy. So, and they were very interested in technique and obviously incredibly abstract. They're just making clouds and lines. So what Rachel is saying is that we should think of Wayne Thibault as being in the Mark Rothko school, where technique is important to him. It just happens that he doesn't paint clouds of color. I apologize if that's not a good enough explanation for Mark Rothko. It looks sort of cloudy to me. Instead, he does the same thing, but he puts the shape into shapes of more recognizable daily objects.
Absolutely correct. And Rothko is a particularly apt example because Rothko and Thibault share a profound concern with the edges of color.
Hmm.
In both those artists, the whole story is when you look at the edges.
Mm-hmm. Now, I would say in my mind, what's the difference between Rothko and even if we think of Thibault as the culmination, which is a wonderful way to think about it, one of the points you make is that not only is it potentially lonely, but it's also quite sexual or sensual. I feel like there's a kind of a way in which my watermelon is very fleshy. It's a very fleshy watermelon. And I don't know if that comes from the edges, as you're talking about, that the watermelon is very fleshily connected to the space it's floating in. And so there's a kind of sensual sexuality to my it's a lonely but sexual watermelon. I don't know. And I don't think about that in terms of Rothko. And I don't know if you would see that that's something special about Thibault, because he also does some pretty sort of almost erotic looking female figures. And food almost looks, we all know that food has a tremendous erotic capacity. And I don't see that discussed as much as I think about when people think about, as I imagine people looking at food and having associations like that to the very fleshiness of food.
Well, and there's a lot of painting that wants to be licked in Wayne Thiebaud's.
Yes,
all that frosting.
all that ice cream.
All that ice cream. There's a lot of licking that needs to go on.
Yes,
but
that's a very good point.
One of the great pleasures I had in really spending some time thinking about that early work, that breakthrough work from the early 60s, is Wayne had a new bride in Betty Jean. Mm-hmm. And I think there are a lot of paintings where you can see both him falling in love with her, but also the pleasures of the body that happen mm-hmm. in those early years together. I think it's a very real part of what he does.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great point and something else for us to think about. The other thing I feel with these paintings is that they are very much about, and you talk a little bit about this, they're very much about the viewer. That after a while, you get very aware, living with my watermelon as I have, that I am looking at the watermelon. And I'm very aware of myself as a watermelon watcher. So I'm curious about how the painting, or to what extent, as you discuss here, it makes us aware of ourselves as voyeurs, which I think all paintings do to some extent, because all paintings are there for us to look at. But there's a kind of explicitness, sort of like Hopper, maybe, that we feel a little bit more like we're looking at something. And we're supposed to be a little bit aware of the fact that we're supposed to be aware of that we are actually kind of voyeuristically looking at, maybe it's somebody else's watermelon, I don't know.
Naomi, you do such honor to this work. These are topics that are not talked about nearly enough about Thiebaud's art. I will go back to the connection to pop art and commercial art. Wayne borrowed freely. He was a graphic designer before he committed himself to a life as a painter, and he borrowed liberally from the tactics of commercial design and putting objects on display.
Yes.
That is a watermelon. The reason it's in a white background is think of ads from the time.
Yes.
Think of how you photographed objects on a white backdrop, and it was to put them shiny and proud and luscious for commercial display. Wayne talks about at the period of looking at the super high voltage commercial lights that were so different than the incandescent bulbs in residential homes. Though he was painting under those kind of lights because the tactics of commercial display was something he was terribly interested in. Mm-hmm. And I found one of the most poignant moments in my journey of discovery of Thiebaud's art was a film his wife Betty Jean made of him in, I think it was 1972. And it opens with a shot. We are looking at the back of Wayne Thiebaud's head as he's looking in a store window at hundreds of objects on display. So you are on the money.
Now, can people see that film? I'm very curious because I think that that's a very interesting way to enter into his art, because so much of it is sort of looking at it through his eyes through a window. So there's almost as if everything has both the immediacy that I can almost touch the watermelon because it's so real. But on the other hand, I don't think I can, because it would be as if, why can't I touch that watermelon? Well, there's a glass in front of it. There's something that separates us from something that's both so close and yet so distant, in the way that food in a store window has that. You can get so close to a banana, right? Looking in the window, right? You can't touch that banana.
A certain distance is what we've called it. All of Wayne's paintings keep you. They are open and available, but keep you at a certain distance. Mm-hmm. The great news about seeing the film is that in January of 2021, we will celebrate the Thiebaud Centennial at the Minetti Schrem Museum. We have an exhibition planned to honor his 100th birthday, and we intend to show the film again as part of that exhibition.
Okay, so we can put that on our calendar. There's one more thing I wanted to ask about, because I like these, I think it's important to introduce our listeners to sort of technical terms of art, and you use the word inherent indexicality. And that's a word I use a great deal because I teach religion, and in ritual, indexicality is very important. It means being actually in the same space as. So it's the kind of thing in religion you want to make sure there's a divine presence, for example. So there'll be a lot of things in a religious ritual that point towards a divinity, right? But presumably that's not exactly the same kind of indexicality.
Well, it... this could be the basis of an interesting argument to see how similar it is. Part of what I'm talking about is a very literal form of indexicality, of Wayne's mark making, of how much those brushstrokes record the physicality of his mark making, of the direct influence of the artist on the canvas, mm-hmm. which of course is completely opposite of Warhol and Lichtenstein, who were doing screen printing and making symbols more than they were objects that bore the trace of this physical touch of the artist.
Mm-hmm.
So that is part of what we were talking about. The other interesting part with Thibaut is how that indexicality also extends to the familiar everyday objects that we see all around us. He is creating not a connection to the divine, but a connection to the mundane, to the world that's around us, the watermelon that's on our table, the cupcake we make for a birthday. And I think, like many poets, he invests a great deal of spiritual presence in the mundane and the everyday.
Mm-hmm. That's part of that indexicality. It actually is a fairly complicated idea of indexicality. We say again for our listeners that to index is like to indicate, to point towards. So one of the things that Rachel is saying is that when you look at his art, you see his presence because you see his brushwork. So you look at that and you say, ha ha, that leads me to think of his hand reaching out with the paintbrush, making this mark. But then we have another kind of indexicality because we can bring in our whole conversation we just had about looking.
Yes.
So it also points back to yourself. I am looking at these marks made by him. And it's sort of as if he's pointing to me when he's making his mark. He's pointing to me. How? Because he's saying, I am making this mark and you are going to look at it. I am anticipating you as the viewer. I've already looked, and all you're going to do is you're going to step into my indexicality, and you become the looker that I am right now. So he's kind of is there such a thing as a preparatory indexicality?
Maybe we're inventing something on the spot. I do think that is an important part to understand about the power of his art. Overwhelmingly, he paints small canvases. Certainly much smaller than the huge canvases that abstract expressionists
like
were known for.
Like Lichtenstein, those great big, huge ones.
And part of it is he is an intimate painter. It is an intimate experience that he creates between himself and his viewer.
Mm-hmm. In that way, I kept thinking, even though he's quite different, and I worry, you always worry about these comparisons, but I did keep thinking of Hopper because I felt like you could see a Hopper painting and you would be very much aware you're a voyeur because he also often has a window. You are literally looking through a window at part of a thing. And then what would happen is that Thibaut would come and do just the piece of pie from the Hopper painting, and somehow it would be unreal in the same way that the Hopper paintings are really quite unreal
right.
as well, and that would be unreal. Now, I don't know if this is quite fair to end our discussion on Thibaut, but in some ways I think he is not the hardest person to look at in terms of his art. And maybe that's a good thing in that people, that there's a way in which you could look at him on many different levels. And maybe people wouldn't have thought of many of the things we discussed today, but people can still get a lot of pleasure. Look at the number of birthday cards that are made out of his birthday cakes. I think one of the hardest parts is to go from someone like him, and this I think is a very important point for us to try to address, to try to help our students or just viewers in general. When you go from something that's immediately appealing at some level to a lot of modern art, which is much harder to look at, how do we get people to go from the birthday card to some of the other things which they're likely to encounter when they come into your museum that don't come out and say you're going to enjoy looking at me, or I have lots of different things, or there's at least something recognizable. So how would you help people, many people I've seen who go to an art museum who stand puzzled
mm-hmm.
in front of art and are just not sure how to connect to sometimes an entire exhibit?
It's true, especially when sometimes we just did an exhibition last fall about Bruce Nauman. And Bruce Nauman's purported objective is to make you uncomfortable. His work is most successful when you have a visceral reaction to it. So all artists aren't even going after beauty. The most important advice I can give to people was actually given to me very early in my career. A director of education said to me, when I don't like work, it's usually because I don't understand it. Hmm. If you can open yourself up just a little bit to ask a question, even if you hate the work, to say, what on earth was this stupid artist trying to do? You'll usually find a way in.
Well, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but it's funny that you should use Nauman because I have struggled. So you're going to have your opportunity to now open my eyes to this, because I was at PS1 in New York and I saw the Nauman exhibit and I felt like it was dusty. I felt like it just was old. I felt like it hadn't aged well. I mean, these may be heretical words to say in front of these high, but I'm just saying that I think sometimes people feel that way when they look at contemporary art. Sometimes it is dusty. Sometimes the pieces are leftover parts from something that may have been, what I'm saying, more alive.
Absolutely.
In a previous age. And they don't, they seem more corpse-like or more just, that's what I meant about dusty, and kind of taken out of a context and hard to understand in their current context. So I wonder, how do we then, we look at something like the Nauman, we go in there, maybe with my children going in there, and there'll be something that's vaguely, as you say, supposed to make me feel uncomfortable. I'm feeling uncomfortable. Okay, I'm in there looking at my one. What was a great thing when I went to the New Museum, and there was a video display by the woman, the British woman's artist who they just had an exhibit there. I forget her name, and there was a little boy there watching the video, and she was smearing her boyfriend with oil as part of this performance piece.
Right,
and the little boy turned to his mother and he said, "Do you think he knows she's filming them?"
That's a great question in the Me Too moment. You know, there is a part of, and we're doing a big conceptual art exhibition this January, a show of Steve Kaltenbach, who was Bruce Nauman's roommate when they were together at UC Davis. And conceptual art, it is difficult sometimes for us to look back and understand how crazy a statement was when it first broke all the rules of art in 1967.
Yes.
So there can be that dusty quality, and that's where it's so important to get some context to understand the conventions that these artists were breaking down that made the way for art today. Mm-hmm. I think that's an important part as we start to historicize conceptual art, to understand, to get back in the mindset. I do think, though, with Bruce Nauman, part of what we have to do to really appreciate that work is to understand how simple some of the statements are. One of the videos in that PS1 show that I saw as well, that I was transfixed by, was Bruce, near his home in New Mexico, setting a post hole.
Yes.
That's all it was. He was digging a hole for a post to build the fence to help keep his horses in. But if you gave it some time and you really thought about what on earth is he doing, how could this stupid video possibly have meaning? And Bruce Nauman says part of the experience of his videos is to get bored. We don't give them enough time to get bored. He's playing with duration and attention. That I actually, by the end of my time with that piece, I came away with what a beautiful statement that was on process. If you're going to make a good artwork, or you're going to set a true post hole for a fence, it relies on good process.
Or you're going to write a paper, for
there
example.
You go.
So the way in which process is always part of making. And to go back to your point, very much that many of the Davis artists are very interested in making. And I think that's a very good point. And if you can re-enliven these pieces as being made, which I think is hard. It's just hard.
It's hard
sometimes to see them being, to remember the making of these things and to focus on the idea of all the ways in which things are created and the complexity of the process of creation. I think that's a very interesting way to think about that. And I'm going to use that next time I look at some Nauman. I appreciate all of this fight that's going on now about whether art is over or not. I mean, you do certainly say, because that's what you said in the first half, is that artists are somewhat experiencing somewhat of a problem about what is the role of art. So I've been following the whole Danto argument about, in his arguments about, is art over? If art's not over, what's happening to art? I think it's a very interesting time to go to a museum to think about these questions. So since you've had a lot of time, what's your prediction? I'm sure you won't say that art is over because we just built this art museum. So there's going to be something in there. But where are we going to go from this time now where I do think you're right that many artists are not really sure of their place in society and their role and their importance? It's not at all like some of the ancient things in which you could see the relationship, for example, between the highest levels of government supporting art. That's certainly not the world we live in now.
Well, my interests tend towards painting. It is what I am passionate about. It is what I wrote my dissertation about. One of the things that I'm very interested to see today, and you saw some of it around the controversy around the Whitney Biennial last time around, is that there's a real resurgence of painting today. Hmm. There are artists who are investing in that medium in new and different ways, and in particular in the representation of race, that are exciting and challenging and opening up new possibilities for that medium, and that excites me.
I think that's a really good point. And I will say, based on the art that we toured in South Africa last summer with my family, there's a lot of painting. Painting is all kinds of things. So there seems to be something about the human interest in selecting down. You can only use this amount of space and you can only use one dimension, and then trying to do something with that selection. There's a kind of interesting, I think it's true in many areas where, like chefs are, you can only use certain number of foods, exactly. But then you try to explicate them. So there's something about the selection down to just the canvas space. I was also struck there, and I'm wondering whether you would agree, there were a lot of other things, for example, pottery. I was quite struck by a pottery coming into its own as a form of what we would consider high art or fine art, if you want to use those rather dangerous terms. There was a lot of investment in very beautiful pottery that I had not seen, I think, back to the ancient world, but it's not something that I had seen maybe in the 60s and the 70s as much. I don't know whether...
It's a perfect time to come out to the museum. On Sunday, we opened the exhibition of Kathy Butterly, a ceramicist who is mid-career, really at the top of her form, and she happened to be Robert Arneson's last MFA student. Mm. For those of you who don't know the story of Robert Arneson, came to UC Davis to establish ceramics as a real medium for making art, as important as sculpture as a vessel or a pot. Mm-hmm. And to just give you a sense of how controversial that was, he was hired into the home ec department because ceramics was for making plates.
Wow.
He got transferred into the art department. His whole career was this fight for the status of ceramics as a proper medium. And right now at the exhibition or at the museum, we see his legacy in the shape of Kathy Butterly's exquisite ceramic sculptures that are about color and form. She calls them paintings in three dimensions.
And that makes you happy.
I love her work. So please come out and see it. It's beautiful. It's very fleshy. The curatorial assistant who worked on the project opened up the catalog when it arrived last Friday and saw, here's a great teaser. She saw the first picture and blushed and immediately closed it.
I was actually going to talk a little bit in the last few minutes we have about what's coming up at the museums to give people some idea of things they can come for. So one of them is the opening is this Sunday, you said.
It was just 2 days ago.
Oh, it was 2 days
Kathy
ago, right.
Kathy Butterly, Color, mm-hmm. Form, and it's open for the rest of the year. So mm-hmm. we close in December. We also opened on Sunday our first exhibition of the permanent collection, and it includes one of Bob Arneson's masterworks, The Palace at 9 a.m., that is here at UC Davis because of the work of the Art Friends, an arts support group in Davis who worked for 10 years to fundraise to bring that sculpture to campus.
Where was it?
It was in the Nelson Gallery. Mm. For a long time, it was in the Alumni Center, and we've built a space just to display it, and we're thrilled to have it on
view.
I see
what you say. Bring. So, and obviously, people can just go to the Minetti Schrem website and find out other material. So if we're... And then I always like to think of a sort of a thought question at the end. What do we want to leave our listeners with? It seems to me that rather than leaving them with a generalized thought about art, we are leaving them, as we said today, with a homework assignment, which is to get up and go out and look at some art. And what better than go to Minetti Schrem? I don't know if there's something else you tell students or you tell people in order to encourage them to come. This case, we've got the particular exhibit of ceramics.
We have these two great exhibitions on view, and as a special treat for summer, every day of the week, our studio is open 11 to 2 with activities you can do at any age. We have plenty of students come in. We have families. We have kids. My favorite moment in the studio is when I see a dad and a kid together. I saw this just the other day where the kid is done and the dad says, I need 5 more minutes, honey. So come on down.
Okay. So, and that, I think one of the things we've learned today is that that is the sign of the UC Davis art tradition. We're makers. So our final thought today is go out, make something. And from 11 to 2, you can make it. You'll get all these great supplies. That's the great thing. It's fun to make things when you have a lot of supplies. So I want to thank you very much for coming on Office Hour today. And this show will be available on our archive, officehourucdpodcast.com. And it will have a link to the art museum as well as to Rachel's site. And I encourage people to look that up. And thanks very much for coming on the show today.
Such a pleasure to have a great conversation.
Terrific. And meanwhile, we want everybody to stay tuned because we've got radio theater coming up next. So that's always a lot of fun. And I will be back next week. We will go out and knock on somebody else's door. So until then, get out there and make something. Bye.